ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A long-standing feature of crime in New South Wales is that regional communities tend to experience higher rates of crime than in the city. But what we can see is that this gap has grown over time as crime reductions in Sydney have exceeded those in the regions over the past two decades.
New research shows the rates of property and violent crime in regional New South Wales were about 60% higher than in Sydney last year, prompting calls for greater intervention. And we'll head to Robe, a small tourist town on South Australia's limestone coast, where scarce records and damaging stereotypes have overshadowed the way many remember the town's history. But now historians are working to set the record straight and shine a light on the important role migrants played in how the region developed.
After two generations, when people have forgotten the history, they start using this term invasion. You know, when Robe was invaded by the Chinese, and so you get this exaggerated sense of fear and loathing. And it all has to do with white Australia and all has to do with people's attitudes at that time to Chinese rather than what was happening.
I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk country, Perth. We start in Ballarat, where a mine worker has been killed and another critically injured in a rock fall at the Ballarat gold mine. Police say 30 workers were 500 metres underground and 3 kilometres from the mine entry at Mount Clear when they were caught in the rock collapse just before 5 on Wednesday evening. Reporter Lexi Junewick has been at the Ballarat mine today. Lexi, what can you tell us about what's happened there at the Ballarat gold mine?
Well, Alex, it's, you know, just over 24 hours since this shocking incident unfolded at Mount Clear. We've learned that the 37-year-old man who died in this incident is Kurt Hourigan. He's a father of three from Bruthen, which is a small town in Gippsland. And the other man injured is a 21-year-old from Ballarat. So he was flown to the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne following this rock fall that unfolded yesterday afternoon, and he remains in a critical condition this evening. As I mentioned, so it was just before 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon when this rock fall is believed to have happened about 500 metres underground and 3 kilometres away from the mine entrance. What we do know is that 30 workers were working underneath the ground when this rock fall happened. We understand that 28 of those workers were able to seek refuge in what's been described as a safety pod. Unfortunately, two of the workers, that 37-year-old Kurt Hourigan and the 21-year-old from Ballarat, became trapped. Emergency services worked around the clock to try and free this man. They managed to extract the 21-year-old and he was flown to hospital, but sadly, Mr. Hourigan's body was located just after 5 o'clock this morning. So as a result of this deadly incident, police have launched an investigation. They'll be acting on behalf of the coroner, and WorkSafe Victoria is also investigating as a result of these probes into the incident. All operations at the mine have ceased and it remains unclear as to when they will restart. We heard from WorkSafe today about their investigation.
This is a tragic incident. It's a really complex matter, so there is a real detail of expertise required to ensure that we can do that thorough investigation and really understand what's occurred and contribute to ensure safety in the future. So we've got a large number of our team and we will work on it as long as we need to ensure that we understand what's occurred.
That's Dr. Narelle Beer from WorkSafe Victoria earlier today. Now, Lexi, the Australian Workers Union also addressed the media today. What have they had to say?
They have, Alex. So they've said that this incident is an absolute tragedy, but indeed was one that was avoidable. So they raised concerns about the conditions the men were working under. We understand that they were mining using a technique called airlegging, and that involves hand drilling in smaller, less stabilised offshoots of main mining tunnels. So they raised concerns about those conditions the workers were under, and today have also flagged that They'll be pushing for Victoria's industrial manslaughter laws to be used following this death. They say that even though something like 169 Victorian workers have died on the job, only one of those deaths have been prosecuted since the state implemented these laws in 2020. Now, at this town hall or trades hall meeting, I should say, Victorian Secretary Ronnie Hayden spoke to the media. Take a listen to what he had to say.
We had two workers that were airlegging, which is a manual style of mining. It's our understanding that they were working under unsupported ground and that ground gave way, trapping both miners and killing one. This is absolutely devastating. It's devastating because yet we've lost another worker and no worker should be injured or die at work. But it's even more devastating because this should have been avoided. They should not have been doing that task in that mine. We are going to be pushing very hard to make sure that the industrial manslaughter laws are used. Since industrial manslaughter laws have come in, we've had 169 Victorians killed at work. This year we've had 12 Victorians killed at work. And in the time since these laws have come in, we've had one prosecution and no jail time.
That's Ronnie Hayden from the Australian Workers Union. Now, Lexi, there have been concerns about safety at this mine in the past. Has that been raised today?
Yeah, it definitely was, Alex, with WorkSafe, who, as you can imagine, given that there is an investigation underway at the moment, were very limited in what they had to say. But we understand that it's the third incident at Ballarat Gold Mine in the past 17 years. So in 2007, a tunnel collapse resulted in 27 miners being lifted to safety through an air vent. And just as recently as 2021, a rock fall trapped machinery, but no workers were hurt. So no doubt the history of this mine will be looked into by WorkSafe as part of this fresh investigation.
And finally, Lexi, we spoke to you only a few days ago about missing Ballarat mother Samantha Murphy and a man being charged with her alleged murder. It's been a really challenging time for the Ballarat community. How are people there processing this news now?
Yeah, you're incredibly right, Alex. For a city which is home to about 100,000 people, a lot of people do know each other in Ballarat. And as you can imagine, incidents like this, whether it be the missing persons case of Samantha Murphy and her alleged murder, the recent fires that were just on the outskirts of town, and indeed this mine collapse, people know each other in this community, and they, you know, whether it's a brother, a relative, a friend, someone goes to footy with, it's that kind of cumulative trauma, I think we can describe it as, that these events will be having on the community, as we kind of grapple with the significance of these events. So speaking to the mayor, it's clear that the message is to the community, talk to one another, and it's so important that they support each other throughout this time. So I think the mayor's described Ballarat as a completely resilient city. As someone who lives here myself, I can agree with that, and I think it will just take time for people to process these events. And as I pointed to, the mayor saying it's so important for people to talk to one another, I think, that is a key right now.
Lexi Junowick is our reporter there in Ballarat. Once again, Lexi, thanks so much for speaking to Australia Wide.
Thanks for your time, Alex.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
Let's head to New South Wales now, where there are renewed calls for greater government intervention when it comes to tackling crime. It's long been known that people living in regional parts of the state experience higher rates of crime than their city counterparts, but new data shows that gap is growing. The New South Wales government is trying to crack down on crime in the regions, but as Newcastle reporter Romy Stevens found out, some don't think the recent reforms go far enough.
Anglican Church Minister Simon Waller never thought he'd experience one break-in, let alone four. His Gunnedah home in the New South Wales northwest was targeted at the end of 2022 and his car was stolen.
My wife and I were woken up with a balaclavaed person standing in the doorway of our bedroom. When we were disturbed, he bolted and that's when we noticed the car was missing.
So far this year, the local church has been broken into three times. The events have had a prolonged impact.
My wife felt quite threatened, so we actually had to rearrange our bedroom so she wasn't sleeping at the entrance to the room. She's also found it really difficult to get to sleep, and when we hear noises in the house, there's a hypervigilance.
Simon Waller's experience with crime in the state's regions isn't isolated. New analysis from the Bureau of Crime Statistics and Research shows in 2023 the rate of property and violent crimes was about 60% higher in regional areas compared to Sydney. Sexual assault reports have spiked by more than 100% in the regions over the past decade, while the increase was 70% in the city. BoxR's Jackie Fitzgerald says it doesn't mean crime is escalating, but it does show strong disparities.
A long-standing feature of crime in New South Wales is that regional communities tend to experience higher rates of crime than in the city. But what we can see is that this gap has grown over time as crime reductions in Sydney have exceeded those in the regions over the past two decades.
Community groups and local politicians aren't happy and they want more attention given to the problem. The first step, they want an official inquiry examining regional crime. Jamie Chaffee's the chair of the Country Mayors Association. He says the problem is so widespread it needs a thorough examination.
The only way to really get to the bottom of these issues and have a pathway for government to actually make meaningful change, we think, is to have an inquiry where the hearings are in regional communities.
At this stage, though, such an option is unlikely, as the New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns, isn't convinced it's the right step forward.
We believe we have enough information from BoxR, as well as the evidence from civic leaders, as well as those that work in the criminal justice system, more than enough evidence for us to act. We don't need greater or further inquiry.
The Premier this week announced a $26 million package to support community safety in regional areas with a focus on youth crime. As part of that, a pilot program will be set up in Moree, more than 170 kilometres north of Gunnedah. It will include new bail accommodation for young people, improved out-of-hours activities and additional resources for local and children's courts.
I want to make sure that interventions that we make in Moree are evidence-based, that we can get the results out of that community and we can apply schemes that we know will work right across this state.
The government is also introducing legislative changes to strengthen bail laws, but experts such as University of Newcastle criminologist Xanthi Mallett aren't sure this approach will help.
What we need to do is work with families early on when children are young before they even get involved in these antisocial behaviours. Give these young people those opportunities and stop that cycle.
Megan Boschel is the Central and Far West Manager for Mission Australia. In parts of those regions, rates of property and violent crime are at least double the state average. She oversees Youth on Track, an early intervention program for young people who are at risk of ongoing contact with the criminal justice system.
They might already be engaged in some antisocial behaviour, disengaging from school, antisocial peer groups, some of those red flags that we might start to see.
She says a lack of resources is one of the main reasons kids in regional areas might engage in crime.
They may be disengaging from education, but if they're in a community where there's only one school, then they don't have access to another option.
Megan Boschel believes the program is so successful in tackling youth crime because it's place-based.
No community is the same as the next one. So I think it's really important, particularly in regional areas, that it's not just a one-size-fits-all approach.
That's Mission Australia's Megan Boschel, ending that report by Romy Stevens in Newcastle. On South Australia's limestone coast, the small town of Robe is one with a rich and fascinating history. These days, it's a quiet tourist town, but in the 1850s and 60s, it was the starting line for a 400-kilometre-long walk, where around 16,000 Chinese people got off a ship and set off for the Ballarat goldfields. It's one of the most significant events in the town's history, but later tales of the landings have led to myths and misunderstandings. From South Australia, Sam Bradbrook has this report.
Sitting on the beach at the South Australian town of Robe is a monument built in a Chinese style and inscribed with Chinese writing. To first-time visitors, it might seem a little out of place, but it's a marker to one of the most significant events in Robe's history. The discovery of gold across the border in Victoria in the 1850s sparked a gold rush, with thousands travelling to areas including Ballarat, Bendigo and Daylesford to strike it rich. This included thousands of Chinese people, which prompted the Victorian government to institute a £10 poll tax on foreign arrivals by sea. But it didn't include crossings over its land border. So around 16,000 Chinese people landed in the small town of Robe and walked 400 kilometres to the goldfields instead.
Well, that's the first myth. Actually, Robe was a booming town at the time, not because of the Chinese gold seekers, but because wool was booming. And actually, it became a significant port. So there was a lot of through traffic through Robe at the time. So it was never a big place, but it wasn't as obscure as people might think.
Dr. Michael Williams, a Chinese-Australian historian from Western Sydney University, is putting together the first academic study of what's become known as the Robe Walk. Records are scarce of the event, which Dr. Williams says has led to a number of myths and misunderstandings. For example, many later retellings describe the voyages as disorganised, leaving travellers stranded in Robe. Instead, they came with provisions for the walk and with items to trade with locals to make money for the journey.
Certainly a fascinating story. Of course, it involves hardship and you don't want to discount that. But the myths have grown over the years to exaggerate this hardship. And you'll find that most of those myths didn't come about until about the 1900s or about 1920s, when people had forgotten all about the history. And that's when you first hear the term invasion. At the time, contemporary reports, nobody considered an invasion at all. They were just surprised there were so many people coming, but they just took it in their stride and did what they did with it and watched the people go by and sold them sheep and did all the rest of it. But then after two generations, when people have forgotten the history, they start using this term invasion. You know, when Robe was invaded by the Chinese. And so you get this exaggerated sense of fear and loathing. And it all has to do with white Australia and all has to do with people's attitudes at that time to Chinese rather than what was happening.
The walk from Robe was long, but it wasn't really unusual for the time. Around 20,000 people from Adelaide also walked out to the goldfields, leaving a hole in the young city's population. Former local Liz Harfel wrote a book on the Robe Walk. She says the new interpretations of history should be embraced.
I mean, just think about Rome in the day. 200 people in a really isolated community, probably one of the most isolated in the Commonwealth, only accessible by ship and really rough bush tracks, less than 200 people in the town, and within a year, over 14,000 Chinese landed on the beach. And so an extraordinary moment in history, and just trying to picture that in my head, what that must have looked like and felt like to the people living in Robe was a challenge.
In Robe today, you can learn about the Chinese arrivals in the town's museum, but the displays are in the process of being removed so they can be fact-checked and updated. Valerie Monahan, who runs a museum, says correcting the myths are important, but they have kept a long-running interest in the Robe Walk.
I don't see any real harm in that. A lot of people, you know, aren't that worried about getting the facts to be really, really specific. So I think it's kept, you know, I know those myths have been kept alive by people around the place, but it's still, you know, kept people interested in the overall happenings in Robe.
While the Robe Walk may have been more peaceful than first thought, Chinese experiences on the goldfields were anything but. Anti-Chinese sentiment was rife and they were often subject to violence and riots. Following the gold rush, the Australian government enacted laws to limit non-white immigration to Australia, leading to the White Australia policy. Dr. Williams says this policy indirectly led to the scarcity of records documenting the Robe Walk.
Well, I think they come from this idea that the Chinese are exotic. So by the time Australia gets through its White Australia period in the 1900s and starts, you know, systematically eliminating non-white people from its history, it does that not just through immigration policy, but it does it from its history as well. You read history books from the 1920s and that you don't get any mention of anybody. You barely get any mention of Aboriginal people, let alone anyone else who's not white.
Western Sydney University Chinese-Australian history expert Michael Williams completing that report from Sam Bradbrook in South Australia. Fire is having a devastating impact on the largest temperate woodland on Earth. The Great Western Woodlands, which stretches from the West Australian wheat belt right through to the Nullarbor Plain, is burning increasingly often, which destroys rare old growth trees. But advocates hope a new mapping project could help protect them.
Les Schultz stands beside towering gum trees and arcs a finger through the air. He's retracing the course of a crash-landing space station.
I watched it go across the sky here, and it kept going and went past Belladonna to land over there.
In 1979, America's first space station, Skylab, fell back to Earth near Belladonna on Western Australia's Nullarbor. The story brought international recognition to the area and is still kept alive through museum exhibits and souvenirs. Now, 45 years later, the area has received more good fortune from above. Drones, planes, and even the International Space Station have flown over Naju country as part of a project to protect one of its most precious features, the world's largest temperate woodland.
They are a wonderful and amazing place, partly because of just how vast they are. It's multiple times the size of a country like Wales, and it's bigger than the size of England.
But Tommaso Jucca, a senior research fellow from the University of Bristol, says climate change and reduced rainfall has put the area at increased risk from bushfire.
Over the last 50 years, almost 40% of the woodland habitat has burnt at least once. And whenever a fire will go through these woodlands, it will reset the stage completely. So trees don't survive these fires. The typical sort of salmon gum and the key species that make up this habitat will not survive fire.
Helen Langley and Darius Evans-Wicker from the Naju Conservation Aboriginal Corporation are particularly worried about old growth stands made up of trees more than 120 years old.
This is a beautiful example of the old growth woodland tree that we're walking up to.
I've taken the beauty of the tree because it's kind of rare to see such a big, large tree. Like, this is something I'd want to show my own family.
Fire never used to touch the old growth trees.
Traditionally, mature woodlands didn't burn. They're wide spaced, and so fires petered out. What we've seen with recent fires, they get a run in the landscape, and they're actually taking out large areas of mature woodlands.
The first step in protecting the old trees is working out exactly where they are. So researchers, including Mr. Jucca, mapped the area in 3D using a technique called LIDAR, which involves firing a laser pulse at the landscape and timing how long it takes to return.
LIDAR technology has typically been operated either from the ground or from airplanes, but never really from space up until 2018. In 2018, NASA launched a new space mission to put a LIDAR sensor into space, and they put it on the International Space Station. The way that the orbit of the International Space Station works means that there are certain areas of the world that are better sampled than others. And somewhat by chance, the Great Western Woodlands happens to be one of the best sampled areas on Earth.
They found that around 40% of the woodlands was old growth trees.
Given how much fire there has been in the region over the last 50 years, was quite a positive result.
Now they want to see those areas protected.
We're hoping with this map there will be more rapid suppression where there's old growth.
Naju elder Les Schultz says the work could also help keep the only sealed road between WA and South Australia open.
We use the firefight also to work with community, especially with the roads, the highways, where these big trucks are bringing food across to Western Australia, across to South Australia, to New South Wales, the transport system. We don't want that to be stopped again.
The Great Western Woodlands meets the Eyre Highway for more than 200 kilometres, but it's closed multiple times in the past month, most recently due to rare flooding, but also due to bushfires. In 2020, fire forced it to shut for 12 days.
Fires were burning through woodlands and burning back into the sand plain, so it is, yeah, caused a great concern for us.
Chris Curtis is a fire operations officer with the WA Department of Biodiversity, Conservations and Attractions. He says they'll be using the LIDAR map to plan their prescribed burns.
Woodlands in general doesn't respond well to fire. We use the map to target or find where those old areas, old growth woodland areas are, and then we can target our aerial prescribed burning up against those woodlands in the sandplain heath. Burning that old senescent sandplain then protects those woodlands from the large-scale summer bushfires.
Valma Saunders has a wealth of knowledge about this area after growing up on the nearby Fraser Range Station. But the Ngadju elder is horrified to see the recent destruction caused by fire and is desperate to see the country better protected.
How do you feel when you go to an area after a fire's been through?
Devastated, because you see the country's gone. It won't come back, not in my lifetime anyway.
Lev Schultz spent much of the past year travelling the world to sound the alarm about climate change. He's dismayed by just how urgent that warning has become in his own backyard.
Continue this fight, not just us to hear locals, but for a community that's still out there wanting to come and have a look at Ngadju country. We're one of a kind on the globe. We want to keep it going, ready for all the other visitors that want to come and see Ngadju country.
Ngadju elder Les Schultz, ending that story by the ABC's Emily Smith. And you can see more on that story this Sunday on ABC TV's Landline. And that's Australia Wide for this Thursday. I'm Alex Hyman. Thanks so much for your company today. I'll be back again with you tomorrow. Hope you can join me then. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.